Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome. Well, maybe you're a first timer. Welcome to this episode of Spill the Wine. I'm Christoph Ellinghaus, and today I'm very excited. You're going to be listening to me talking with Janet Billig-Rich, my very dear old friend, Janet Billig-Rich, I should add. I love her. She's amazing. And I really don't know if there's any other person that had such a tremendous impact on my little record label in the early days, because it was Janet who invited me to go to a studio with her in New York in, gosh, I want to say April of 91. And we visited a young band from LA recording their first album. That band was Hole. The producers were Kim Gordon and Don Fleming. And I later got to put out that very first Hole album called Pretty on the Inside in Europe and the UK on my then very young label, City Slang. So this is a real music biz episode on Spill the Wine. Spill the music biz for a change. And it's a walk down memory lane for us through the grunge years and all that, late 80s, early 90s. We talk about Janet coming up in New York in that time, where she was basically entertaining the busiest crash pad of the town, while she was working as a manager. She was initially managing bands, then she moved to Caroline Records as a publicist. Then she moved on to Gold Mountain Management, started helping to manage Nirvana and Sonic Youth and Beck and whatever else was there. Then she moved on to Atlantic Records. And then eventually she started her own management company called Manage This, with Guided by Voices, Cibo Matto, and a bunch of stuff. So after all that, after working with all these bands, Hole, Nirvana, Dinosaur Jr., The Breeders, Lemonheads, she then moved to LA to work. Well, she got married, had children, and then she started to work on a dramatically different project that got even bigger than all of those I just mentioned. So this chat covers all of that, all the way from her early days obsession with The Replacements, all the way to Chef's Table, which she wasn't really involved with. But actually, we're ending on wine, which is good, because we went for a glass of wine after this. So listen to us, Janet Billig-Rich and me, in a hotel room in LA a few months ago. I hope you like it. Yeah. So, I don't remember a thing.
I remember nothing. What makes it really easy not to incriminate us.
Have you, when did you move here?
I moved to Los Angeles 15 years ago.
Oh my God, it's been 15 years.
Yeah, it went really fast. Well, I was back and forth for many years. So I was mainly in New York, and then I got a place in Los Angeles because I was doing more business out here. And then I'd be half in LA, half in New York. And then I came for a job for like 3 months and then just stayed. And then I got pregnant.
Well,
then I really stayed.
Okay. But when you worked at the management company,
Echo Mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you out here?
No, I was in New York.
Oh, so you were doing that from New York?
Yeah. When I was working at Gold Mountain in New York in the late 80s, early 90s. And then I left.
No, that's not true. You were working at Caroline even up to
right
91.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so Caroline, I was at Caroline. See, I need to look at a Wikipedia because it has the timeline.
Are you on Wikipedia? Can I look you up on Wikipedia? Of course you are. Everybody is.
I think so.
I don't know if I am.
I don't know. I just know I Google things when I need to know dates because I'm, mm-hmm, like I just told you, I'm like, I was there. I wasn't there. Yeah, I was at Caroline late 80s to early 90s. And then I was at Gold Mountain, mm-hmm, early 90s. And then I had 1 year I went to Atlantic.
When was that?
When I went to Atlantic?
Yeah.
I think 95.
Are you sure?
I was only there a year. It was either 95 or 96.
Wait, I thought that was wasn't that much earlier? Wasn't that between like Caroline?
No. And it was Caroline, Atlantic, Gold Mountain. It was definitely, it was Caroline, Gold Mountain, Atlantic. And then I started Manage This.
Oh, okay.
Which I still currently is my company.
But there's also David Newgarden.
I know. So David Newgarden was my first employee at Manage This. He's the greatest. I love him.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing.
And then when I moved to LA and I was like not managing bands anymore, or I don't even remember what happened. He'll know better. He was like, well, should I keep the name? Because he was basically keeping a bunch of the clients. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, sure. And then I kept the name too. So
okay, so let's go back a little. You did so many different things that we have to put them in line. Let's line them up. So,
okay.
Caroline.
Okay.
You worked at Caroline in New York. How did you get into that job? Was that your first music job?
Yeah, I mean, aside from like working at rock clubs in New York City and selling T-shirts and doing junk around town.
Did you grow up in New York City?
I grew up just outside New York City in the suburbs, mm-hmm. and I used to go to shows all the time. And yeah, so my first job was Caroline, and I got a job. I was going to school, and they were looking for a part-time help, and Keith Wood hired me and Yvonne Garrett, and I worked under Yvonne. And she taught me about press and PR, mm-hmm. and she was so great. And Keith Wood was running the place. And I can't remember the exact order of events, but I ended
up... Oh, come on.
I just remember we worked with like White Zombie and Pussy Galore early on. Mm-hmm. And then I got involved a little bit in A&R, mm-hmm. and we were going to sign Henry Rollins. Mm-hmm. And it got really close, and then it all fell apart, and I remember I was devastated.
Do you remember why?
Yeah, because he went and signed to like a major label instead of coming to like an indie, Caroline.
Mm. Was Caroline a real indie?
No, it wasn't a real indie. It was funded by Virgin, but it operated really on its own.
Okay.
But it was like, it definitely operated on its own because we had our own budgets and this and that. So I remember Keith being like, oh, there's such a downer. What are we going to do to make you feel better or something? Because I was really devastated. Mm. I was like, well, there's this band in California we should sign. That was Hole.
Oh, right.
And they had only had a 7-inch. Mm-hmm. And I remember I talked to Courtney on the phone.
Dick Nail. Was that the first
time? Yeah, Dick Nail. Dick Nail. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Was that on Sub Pop?
No, it was on Sympathy for the Record Industry.
Oh, right.
So I had been talking to Courtney on the phone. She had called me because Babes and Toyland were staying at my apartment, and it was
That's important. Everybody was staying at your apartment.
Everyone stayed at my apartment.
That's what I remember when I came to New York. I was staying at your apartment. Every band was. Did you put? And this apartment was not big.
No, I think it was like 750 square feet.
If you had like a guitar case, then, you know, somebody would have to move out.
Yes. It was very small apartment, but it could sleep many people. I mean, we'd have like 8 and 10 people sleeping.
That's
always a band or two.
Insane. I mean, I remember that place. And
you had a loft bed that had a closet underneath.
Right.
So people would sleep in the closet. You could put two or three people up on the bed.
Yeah.
I had a pull-out couch.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And nobody could move. Everybody now, sleep.
Exactly. Everyone had to go to sleep at the same time.
So that was the New York crash pad.
Definitely.
How did that happen? That you were the goat? Oh, like, I know this woman. She's great. We can stay with Janet.
Yeah. So you know what happened is, so I was working at Caroline. And I think it probably started with Sub Pop. There was Caroline was the distributor for Sub Pop.
Okay.
But they didn't have any staff in New York. So when bands would come to New York and they needed anything, just mm-hmm. where to stay, like where do we stay?
And anything.
How do we, you know, someone wants to do an interview, it would basically end up on my desk. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be like, you could stay with me and you could do your interviews at the office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll help you organize sound check and this or that, because no one had tour managers or everyone was just in a van.
Right.
So I ended up being like the crash pad. And then people would be like, oh, you're going to New York? You could stay at Janet's.
So word got out, and then that just happened.
Yeah, exactly.
And it wasn't just sub pop bands, right?
No, then it became like really lots of different bands and artists and musicians. And yeah, it was funny.
I know. I stayed there a number of times. It was great.
Oh, yeah. Tons of like record people.
So and this was Avenue
C.
C and 7th.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And it was like full on. I mean, we're talking like 89, 90. There's drug. It was the crack hell, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
And the whole place was just,
Yeah, it was muggings all the time and drugs everywhere. Tompkins Square Park hadn't been cleaned up yet. Yeah. It was just full of...
It felt real scary. I remember that. I was like, I'm walking alone.
Yeah. If you weren't used to New York City, this was like...
Which, of course, I wasn't.
Yeah. This was like the worst. And... Yeah, it wasn't gentrified yet, and there was no public transportation down there. So you had to walk.
St. Mark's Place was...
So you walked, no matter what, it was a 20, 30-minute walk to anywhere that had anything.
So how did you get into, like, so how did you get into music? What was that? How became music the, how became it the big love?
I just always loved music. Right. I started going seeing live bands when I was 12, 13 years old.
Did you ever play an instrument yourself?
Played cello.
Oh, that's very classic of you. That's very classy of you.
Yes, exactly.
And did you come out of a musical household?
Or? Not at all. No? I never knew there was a music business at all. Mm-hmm. I had no, I was managing bands, making real money before I realized like, oh, this is a business. I can do this. I didn't know one person in the music business.
Who were you managing?
Well, I met Skunk and like,
Oh, Skunk.
Yeah, when I was like 17 or 18, maybe. I think they were the first band I managed.
Right on. And they were New Yorkers, right?
Yeah, they were from New Jersey, and I met them at like hanging out at like CBGB's Sunday matinees, like when Matt. We were all teenagers.
Weren't they all called Matt?
Three of them were called Matt, yeah. And Matt Sweeney has gone on to true greatness. From what I understand, yeah. I don't know.
Are you in touch?
Yeah, I mean, I saw him. I went to see Iggy Pop play, and there was Matt Sweeney playing guitar on stage. That was amazing.
All right.
Yeah, so, but we hang still. Yeah, I mean, he's in touch. We're in touch once in a while.
Skunk were great.
They were awesome. Yeah, they were totally awesome. But, like, I had no idea there was a music business. Literally no clue. I had no idea how records were made, how they got put out. No idea. I grew up, my parents were teachers and social workers. I grew up in a pretty blue collar.
So how did you end up working with these bands?
I don't know. I just pretended I knew what I was doing.
And
I was like, I could figure this out. I don't know. I was like, you want to put out a record? Yeah, let's figure it out.
So Skunk were the first ones, and they did something with Twin Tone, right?
Twin Tone, yeah. I signed them to Twin Tone.
You signed them to this great label in Minneapolis.
Which I was obsessed with because my very, very first favorite band was The Replacements.
Oh, that's right.
And still absolutely my favorite band ever.
Were you happy about that reunion?
Very. Yeah. I went to see many, many shows. I went to Denver. You know. I went to Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah. So you... That was it, the Replacements.
Yeah.
Ah, and so you were in with all the Twin Tone people.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, so I met some of those folks. Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, hey, I've got this band from
Three
Mats.
Completely, yeah. It just weirdly, I don't even remember how it all went down, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
They got a record deal. I was managing a rock band.
They were rocking out.
They were awesome.
Yeah, they were great.
And I don't know if that record still stands up. I imagine it does. Has it been re-released?
Didn't they do a couple?
Yeah. The first one was awesome. I don't remember the others. Is that terrible? Can you erase that?
And then this can all be edited. And they toured with Babes in Toyland, right?
Yeah. And now I can't remember. And then it gets all – I'm not sure how I met anybody. But Babes in Toyland definitely stayed at my house. And I probably knew them – from Minneapolis, because I ended up going to Minneapolis and hanging out and knowing this band and that band.
And then somehow there was an opening at Caroline.
Yeah, like I think I was just like going there. It was a part-time thing. I was going to school in New York. And
so then you were talking to we jump a little. We go back to you talking to Courtney.
Oh, yeah. So we couldn't sign Henry Rollins. Yeah. So it was such a, I was so devastated that we lost Henry Rollins. that Keith was like, well, what are we going to do to, you know, perk you all up? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, there's this band in California I think we should sign. I'd never met them.
On a 7-inch single.
Based on a 7-inch single. And also Courtney talking about her vision for the band and talking to Eric. Like I ended up talking to both of them, but really like Courtney just had this huge vision.
Really?
And I was completely on board. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so how would you go about that? How did you get in touch with them? Was there a phone number on the 7-inch?
No, Courtney would just call my apartment.
She found you.
She found me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, would call a lot.
yeah, she did.
She was very assertive.
Uh-huh. And then you were sold without...
Yeah, and then I told Keith, I was like, we really should make a record. Mm-hmm. We should make a record with this band. They're pretty great. And Courtney was like, really into who was the producer and blah, blah, blah. And we had just made a record with Gumball, with Don Fleming. And Courtney was obsessed, loved Sonic Youth. Like, if it had anything to do with Sonic Youth. And I was like, I'm friends with Sonic Youth. Let's have Kim produce the record. Because Courtney was so, you know, just like everything like about her. Like, we should have everything female around us. So I was like, Kim should produce the record. And then I think Kim brought in Don.
Oh.
I can't remember how that. So Kim and Don produced Hole's first record.
Right. And that was in New York. So Caroline really, yeah, that was, I remember that was in New York because I was in New York and you said, there's this girl down the road. They're making a record. You should meet her.
Right.
And this was what, spring 91, I think.
You would have all the, I have no idea. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, I never kept a journal, but.
I never wrote anything down. Yeah. I have no idea. There was no computers. There was no like.
But that, so, so there was some, you went in a real sort of investment mode. It was like Keith would say, yeah, okay, let's make this record. You set a budget and then you flew the band over and then you made.
I think it was that we spent $12,000 making. I think that was the whole deal.
Okay.
It was 12 grand.
Oh, pretty on the inside.
You're pretty came on out the inside.
Teenage
yeah.
whore.
Oh my God. It was so, that record was so great.
Hell yeah.
And Courtney like blew my mind lyrically. Like, and again, I was really young. I didn't know, and I didn't have a big scope of like knowing a ton about music. But to me, she was Bob Dylan. Like she, her lyrics, I thought she was so incredible. And so I was so moved by her, like for real.
Mm-hmm.
And then the record I thought was so great.
When I was a teenage whore.
I did. I thought that was so great.
Okay. So you made that record and then that record, I remember that they did, that was a good one. So, That was the time when the new music seminars were still going.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always what, July, right? Middle of
yeah, in the
middle
summer.
Middle of the summer, real hot.
Yeah.
And they were opening, I think the big, your lounge show was, you were launching them at CBGB's.
Right.
Them opening for your other band.
With Smashing Pumpkins, right?
Were they also on Caroline?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But wasn't that some fake deal they were signed
correct.
To Virgin?
Yes, and- because it's funny. I get credit for signing the Smashing Pumpkins because it was around the same time as Hole.
Mm-hmm.
But I had absolutely nothing to do with it. I had less than nothing
so
to do with it.
So what was the thinking then? Was it like, okay, we're going to sign. We've signed this band on Virgin. They're really underground.
Correct. Williams signed them to Virgin. And Mark's brilliant, and he's still brilliant. He's an incredible music person and has a great sensibility around him.
I don't
him.
Know who that is, but...
He was like early days REM. He's from Georgia. He's just like, just gets music in a really deep way. He's still, I mean, he's signed like, I don't know who, but big artists.
Is he still in the game?
Very much so. I think he runs like either Sony or Columbia or, yeah, he's mage. But he signed this band Smashing Pumpkins to Virgin. He signed Smashing Pumpkins to Virgin and they wanted to put out like an EP on an indie label.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, oh, Caroline.
Yeah, we have a fake indie label in-house.
Correct.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So they get shipped to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the EP and I was like, this is fucking great. And got to know them a bit. And I always thought Billy was really talented.
Well, you were always hands-on with everything that you were doing. So what I'm sure, did you actually get involved in the EP and in the making of this band, or was it just a name on the cover? and it was all worked by the Virgin people.
No, oh no, we worked that record. I was I was the publicist, and I was definitely super hands-on on early Smashing Pumpkins, absolutely, and got to know the band pretty well. Yeah, and we did a big showcase at CBGB's. I don't know if it was the same year.
As big as it gets at CBGB's.
Exactly, it was packed.
Of course it was the same year. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the summer, the New Music Seminar of 1991.
Yeah, that's not
true. I remember
right.
I was, and didn't they have a thing, Courtney and Billy? Like a fling?
It might have been later. Courtney and Billy definitely have always, on and off, had a love affair for sure. I mean, a hate affair.
I found myself in a taxi ride from Midtown down in the middle between these two. And they were just at it. They were just bickering. And I remember that she was shouting at him. He was shouting at her. I sat in the middle. You remember that scene from Quadrophenia? Where the, that's how I felt. Like, what on earth am I doing?
Here?
How did I get in here? And these two, and I remember that. Whatever they were fighting about, he ended the fight with the sentence, "Courtney, I can't help it that I'm a guitar god." I was like, okay.
That sounds exactly like Billy Corgan. Yeah. But in his defense, he is a guitar god. So yeah, self-identifying as a guitar god.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I never cared much for that band. I don't know. They never spoke to me really.
Right. I hear you. A lot of people didn't like them. More people did like them than didn't like them. But I think there was always like a feeling that they were like fake or not authentic.
Well, I think that it was more like because he was so full of himself. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, they got very successful and all that. I think because he was so full of himself, that just rubbed people the wrong way.
Right. And I think he just really needs a hug from the world, which Courtney and him have in common.
Yeah.
They both are just, I mean, which so many artists do, but they're just like seeking a hug.
Yeah.
They need love.
Yeah. So they, so that was the first time I saw Hole and the first time I saw the Pumpkins at CB's. And that was and Hole were just like, I mean, it was amazing.
Amazing,
was,
yeah, right?
And it was largely Eric. You know, Eric was just the star of, and Courtney of, you
talk
know,
about a guitar god though. I mean, Eric just is so minimized.
But a whole different sensitivity and sensibility.
And
the rhythm section wasn't all that, you know, that was still a bit of amateur hour.
Yeah, they were learning. Yeah. They were learning their instruments.
Yeah. And Courtney was good. You know, she was a really convincing front woman, but, and the Pumpkins came on later on. That was a whole different ball game.
Right.
They were much further developed.
They were tighter, a tighter band. The mess of early Hole was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I remember one of the big things we did, a huge money spend for Caroline, was we brought a video director. We had the idea of, you know what, we should make music videos for all these bands. Mm-hmm. They're all playing this showcase.
What a brilliant idea in the age of MTV.
Exactly. We were like, ta-da.
MTV was a mega breaker at that point.
Exactly. Right? So we were like, we better make some music videos. We have all of them playing. Let's get some live footage, make some videos. We'll hire a video director and pay like one price and get all these videos. Mm-hmm. So we ended up hiring Kevin Kerslake. And I don't know how we came across him. I don't know how he ended up in our orbit. Mm-hmm. But he made some incredible videos from just that one show at CBGB's. And then doing some shoots. I remember, I think Courtney loved the video. I think Smashing Pumpkins never used the video Kevin made.
I'm not sure I've ever seen any of that.
One video was for Garbage Man?
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe it was never released. We should look.
Yeah.
We should look on YouTube.
Who owns that stuff now? You know, there's been so much selling and moving on, so I don't really.
I have no idea. Hopefully it reverted back to the artist, but I doubt
probably
it.
Probably not.
Yeah, I doubt it. For our 12,000.
So then that all blows up.
Yeah.
The Pumpkins thing got really, I mean, very
huge.
That was just an EP, and then they made an album and became huge.
Yeah.
But then that was this was all pretty underground because this was not Nirvana had not hit. But
yeah.
It would shortly after. I mean, it was just
Nirvana was still touring like in a van, staying at my place, mm-hmm. like just putting out singles. They were hadn't blown
up. But come
yet.
On, when did Nevermind come out?
It was September
91, same year.
Wow, really?
Uh-huh.
It seemed far apart to me.
No, and then that record hit big.
Immediately.
It like took to number one in January or something.
It was pretty Remember? Big. It didn't go to number one, but all of a sudden, like, it came out and it was just.
Well, Smells Like Teen Spirit, just boom. Just,
right.
That went.
Yeah.
And again, MTV started hammering that.
Yeah.
And, so, and in the wake, Pretty on the Inside came out, and in the UK, Everett True, big champion. I mean, so for my little label, that was just this trailblazer, the door opener for everything.
And right.
Like, all of a sudden, this German dog and his American music were taken seriously in the UK, which previously, hadn't happened. We put some good records out, Lemonheads, Yola Tango, Flaming Lips. But no, it had to be this teenage whore, 7-inch, that all of a sudden people were shouting about.
Right. And yeah. Then, Everett True is like really was this torchbearer for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had been championing the sub pop stuff since 89. So, yeah. So then what happened? You were at Caroline and you saw the world around you explode.
I didn't see anything. I like live in a vacuum.
Did you have a cubicle?
I have my cubicle and I've always just, I live in a vacuum and I have horse blinders on at all times. And it's just how I operate in life. So I saw none of this happening.
Okay, well.
My phone would ring and people would tell me like, oh, you should do this or you should do that. And I'd be like, okay. And I think, I can't remember who called me. It was either John Silver or Danny Goldberg. And they were like, you should come be a manager. We need you at Gold Mountain. They had signed Sonic Youth, and I had a previous relationship with them. They were looking to sign Nirvana.
But John Silver had worked with Sonic Youth for quite some time before that, I think.
Yeah.
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 And Danny Goldberg was not in the picture.
Yeah, no. John went to work with Danny at Gold Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
He was managing. John was a manager, went to work with Danny at Gold Mountain. And then either John or Danny called me and said, you should come be a manager. We have an office in New York. You should go there every day and we'll pay you a couple of dollars and you can manage bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, all right. Like it was literally like that simple. I was just sitting in my cubicle with my blinders on doing my work.
They were like, did you bring in clients?
Yeah. They were like, you should sign some clients. And I was like, okay. And Hole was looking for a manager at that time. They were meeting with all these managers.
Mm-hmm.
And Courtney was like, these guys are fucking idiots, like or whatever she said. And I was like, well, I'll be your manager. And we'll get to work with Danny Goldberg. Like, he knows what he's doing. He worked with Led Zeppelin. Like, he knows everything. And so Courtney was like, sounds good to me. I was, we knew each other very well at that point. We knew each other really well. We had been working together already a year or two on putting out the first album.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to sign to a major label. It was just about which one and all those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And there was never really a question about that Geffen had to sign her.
Not at all.
Because they had to. Imagine there's this bedsheet talk at night and, Kurt's just blown up to become the biggest new thing in music and his wife is signed to a different major label who then says, well, honey, they just gave me such and such for the video and you only get
that. Right. It could have gone that way, but literally only everyone wanted to be where Sonic Youth were, period. It was.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah. It was never about this or that. I mean, Gary Gersh was super charming. David Geffen was like, it's David Geffen. We're all,
was he actually
impressed.
Involved?
He'd make phone call. He'd call. He'd like to make the obligatory phone call of like, sign here, please. No, it was just. He'd make the phone call, but there was an amazing team of people at Geffen who were incredibly talented at what they did and charming and a great meeting. And, so I think
they gave good meeting.
They gave great meeting. Mm-hmm. And I think there was just never any question. It was like Nirvana and Hole separately wanted to be at Geffen.
Okay.
Because that's where Sonic Youth were. Real, I think it was that simple. I mean, maybe I'm simplifying it and I don't remember all the details around it, but I remember both of them had incredible opportunities and could have gone anywhere. They both had lots of offers and opportunities. And
Nirvana as well?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. John, yeah. John was managing them through all that.
Okay.
I think.
And so you became a manager again, which is full circle. Because, you know,
I started managing again. And so I was managing. So I knew I was going to manage Hole. And then someone had called me and introduced me to Kim Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And she had come into my office and she said, "You'll never believe it. Apparently my band, the Pixies, have broken up. I just heard on the radio this morning." So I guess Charles had said something on the radio in Ireland or in the UK somewhere that he was breaking up the Pixies, and he had never mentioned it to Kim. So she had just found out. So we had this funny moment together where mm-hmm. she had just found out her band had broken up. She had already done one Breeders record and was looking to do another and needed a manager. Uh-huh. And I was like, "I'll be your manager." Uh-huh. So then that was my other client. And then someone said Jay Mascis needed a manager for Dinosaur Jr.
Oh, of course.
So I started managing Jay.
Oh, I remember I was staying at your apartment. You were out. Don't know what. The phone rings. We didn't have smartphones or anything. So I thought maybe it's you calling me. And I pick it up and this voice, "Janet." No, it was too fast. "Janet." And it was like, "No, sorry, she's not here right now." "Well, can you tell her Murph needs a double bass pedal?" Boop. He hung up. I was like, I think I relayed the message.
I hope so.
There was the other incident, though, when I was out drinking. So they were on tour. And they were out touring in Georgia or someplace. I was out drinking. I came home really late to your place. And the phone rings and I'm like, I pick up and there's this woman hysterically screaming at me. "I'm in Georgia. I'm in jail. I got picked up speeding, da da da." And, I'm like, "Who are you?" "I'm the tour manager for Dinosaur Jr. You gotta get me out of here." I'm like, "Janet's not here right now. I don't know, what to do." So, we talked for a while until we both realized we both spoke German.
It was Gabriella.
And I was the one phone call she was able to make. And I hung up after that. And I just went to sleep. I was.
You left her in jail?
Well, I didn't know where you were. I didn't know.
Where was I?
I had no idea. Anyways, so I went to sleep. And then late, around noon the next day, I got a hold of you. And then there was this phone call. And you were in a panic. It was like, "Oh my God." And then I think probably helped her. That was you managing them out of jail in Georgia or someplace south.
And all without the internet. Now getting people out of jail in other states is so much easier. You could Google.
There's an app for that.
There is an app for that. Then it was like, I had to really use my resources.
Yeah, probably. But I just felt guilty because I woke up, you know, middle of the day, and it dawned on me. There was this this drunken phone conversation. I was her only phone call.
There she is sitting in jail.
She ended up with me. Oh my God. Yeah.
Oh, so, that's terrible.
We still laugh about that.
That is funny. Yeah. I had a landline.
Yeah.
And that was the main source of communication.
So Dinosaur Jr.
Yeah. And then Lemonheads, Danny Goldberg actually called me about the Lemonheads and said there's a band that's putting out a record on Atlantic and they need a manager and you should do it. And I was like, I've met them before. Met Evan and I knew them and I knew Tommy Johnston, who was the manager before me. And, I was like, "I know Evan. That sounds great. I love the Lemonheads."
Mm-hmm.
And so then I managed the Lemonheads and that was kind of it for a while. I also managed a band called Walt Mink, who I loved mm-hmm. so much, but I don't think anyone heard of them.
But you must have had your hands full with all of that. I mean, Courtney alone.
It was crazy. Yeah. I was really busy and I traveled a ton and my phone rang all the time.
Yeah. Right. Were there cell phones then? No.
I was like, I had a cell phone while I was a manager.
But it was the size of a
purse. It was a big, big, like a two bricks. It was big, and it had this big leather case. And yeah, I did finally get a cell phone. Like, I got the first commercially available cell phone.
So then this is in the midst of Nirvana blowing up to the big time, right?
Yeah, it was huge.
Yeah.
So I was involved also with Nirvana.
Yeah, so you were in the thick of that.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you changed the course of rock. Well, not you, but that band changed the course of rock music.
I was just buckled up and held on.
Right. And then it became real bleak.
Yeah, there was a time period that was a real drag.
People started dying.
Yeah.
It wasn't just Kurt. I mean, come on. I remember Kristen
Paff. Yeah, Paff. That was horrible. That was so horrible.
That was the worst. I mean, that was just...
That was horrible.
Yeah. And more. God. Yeah,
Kristen was tragic because, I mean, they're all tragic. Kurt was tragic. They're all just tragic. It's terrible. Young people, just.
What was this? Why do you think heroin was played such a major role at that time in that particular scene?
It's like opiates now. It just was like
this is different now.
Is it? What about Chester and Chris Cornell like hanging themselves?
Depression?
Caused by opiates.
Yeah.
I don't know. Exacerbated. I shouldn't say caused by. But I think there is something with people sedating themselves and their feelings and their needs. And I don't know. I have no idea. I really don't understand any of it.
I mean, obviously, heroin has been around music since God, the bebop days. Yeah, or maybe exactly. Even longer. Who knows? Yeah. But people.
In the 20s and 30s.
And when did Neil Young do The Needle and the Damage Done? So right. It's been, the dark side has always been there, and some people decided to walk through that door. And, so that happened to this scene, you know, in such a mean way, in such a big way. I remember a Reading festival in the UK where all these bands were playing, and I was just like, who's not on drugs here, please? You know, Pavement weren't.
Well, I had no idea anyone was on drugs, and I know that sounds ridiculous, but I really wasn't aware.
You were living in denial.
Well, I wasn't living in denial. I was working, and I was getting all this stuff done.
You couldn't close your eyes to, you know, the people around you being kind of screwballs. I mean, screwed up.
I just had no experience around drugs. Right. I didn't have a drink of alcohol until I was 27 years old. I had nothing to do with drugs, with alcohol. It was just not in my world at all. Never tried it, never got offered it, nothing.
Hmm.
I never had alcohol. Like, I just lived in this little box. When I say I was in my cubicle with blinders on, I was just like, let's get the work done. Let's get the work done. And people would go out to drinks. I never went out.
But you were part
drinking.
Of a huge machine. I mean, at the time, you know, things got so big that the industry took a hold of it. And then you were in the middle of all of that.
But I was like the cog in the wheel, like doing the work. Right. Like I wasn't like out partying. I was out booking airline tickets, hotel rooms, getting the sound engineer, making sure the double bass pedal was there. Yeah. Like I was like literally the mechanics of it.
I remember this Reading festival that really just, it was a disheartening experience to see all these very talented people really, really being out of it. And I was just like, this is kind of, and this is not my scene, you know, this is
right.
It's not for me. Didn't she come back at some, there was a Reading Fest that she then did. And I remember that. And she shouldn't have done that. I thought.
Well, like after Kurt died, you mean?
Yeah.
Right.
You were there.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, man, these people
need. And she was on drugs?
Oh, yeah.
So I had never, I literally had no idea.
I remember I was just like, these people shouldn't be on this stage right now. They need help. That's what I
figured.
That was my feeling, you know, it was not. So I got myself out of that whole scene. I was like, okay, I got nothing to do.
Right.
With this
anymore. This is too crazy.
Yeah. I was always in it. for the music, and that just was a circus to me.
Right, yeah.
And
people, I think things did go really south.
Yeah, people coming to the main stage to see Hole, but they really wanted to see a car crash. It was
right.
It was just not a good. There was nothing good about this. There was
right.
You know, and the musical delivery, I don't think was particularly special.
Right, right. She probably was disappointed in that show too, I imagine.
I don't think she remembers a thing of it.
Right, maybe.
I mean, that was pretty much a low point, and I was like, okay, I can't take this anymore.
Was shortly after that that I probably stopped managing, that I wasn't managing, that I like dropped my clients and went and worked at Atlantic.
So, and you went with Danny Goldberg to Atlantic.
Yeah, but then he left like the week after I started.
Oh.
Yeah, my Atlantic thing was weird because Danny had been pressuring me to go, and then I finally was like, okay, and then he wasn't there anymore.
Mm.
And it was weird. It was like a weird, I shouldn't have probably left. Like in retrospect, I'm like, what was I thinking? But I think it was such a bummer. The work was a drag. Like managing these bands was like crazy.
Right.
It was getting a little nuts.
So in the wake of all of it, I mean, this was a time when the majors were signing anything and everything that had long hair and a guitar and oh god, also musically just horrible.
And I went from, you know, working with Hole and Nirvana and Dinosaur Jr. and the Lemonheads and to working with like Matchbox 20 and Collective Soul and Hootie and the Blowfish and Jewel.
How did that work out for you?
Well, you know, I find musicians and artists fascinating. I think people that can like sit down and write a song.
Okay.
Like I find that compelling and interesting.
So you were able to adapt.
I could find the good in really almost anything.
Come on, Janet. You had impeccable taste.
I still do have impeccable taste.
Yeah.
So I only was at Atlantic for not even a year and I paid
so
them.
So there's a reason for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I paid them to get out of my deal.
Is it Hootie or Matchbox 20?
I paid them to get out of my deal.
Wow.
Like $100,000.
Well, you must have made more than that then to get
I just wanted slightly more. I basically gave them everything they gave me.
Oh, my God.
Because I was so – and I didn't have to do that. I had no idea. Like, again, like, had no counsel. Like, had no – I was just like, I don't want to work here anymore. Here, can you take your money back?
So you were really in pain. I mean, that was the whole system. The major label system is obviously that they pay you a ton of money so that you can deal with the pain.
You put up with
the bullshit, put up with the crap music, put up with all this shit.
Yeah.
That's, you get a lot of money for that, right?
Well, they pay you a lot. I couldn't believe it. I was like,
there's only
God.
One reason why they pay
this
you so much money.
So much
because
money.
It's so fucking painful.
Well, it's just like everyone just does that. I mean, there's good people at major labels. I think people work hard and there's good people there. For me, it felt like I have been coming from management where you deal with like every tiny aspect of like everything.
Right.
So when you're in like a marketing meeting at a major label and they're like,
of your day.
Right. Exactly. All these meetings and marketing meetings. And they'd be like, yeah, you know, this record's over. And it basically had been out for a week. And you go like, oh my God, do you know how many people are involved in making this record? This is the people, the studio, the engineer, their families, everybody's best friend. Like the circle is so, it's hundreds of people. It's not just this one record. Like,
and of course there's the band that has put their career.
Oh yeah, this is it.
Their one career into the hands of the people who are sitting in this very meeting.
Exactly. And it's really hard to make a shitty record too. You know, like people put their life into that also.
So they really felt responsible for these artists and said a week after release, this record's
no
dead.
One felt dead. Any responsibility.
No.
Like that's what struck me. Like I was like, huh? And it was like they'd go on to the next. And I just like, that killed me. I was like, this is crazy.
So that killed the spirit.
Yeah. So that to me, I was like, I can't be around this. Mm-hmm. I was just going to, I want to go back. I want to manage rock bands, but I want to do it myself. I don't want to be at a big company. I just want to like be in my little cubicle with my blinders on and just do my thing. And that's
well,
when
you can't have blinders on when you manage bands because you need to see the bigger picture, Janet. You
maybe that's been my problem.
Get off it. Get off that. I'm not buying that. I am just not buying
but
that.
But blinders on the sense that like all I really focused on was my clients.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and not this whole, not sort of all this clutter and white noise.
So then you just set out for yourself.
Yeah, because as a manager, for me, my point of view is always like, I'm a facilitator. Like, I never learned how to be a manager. I didn't go to college to be a manager.
Right.
Like, I don't know, like, what's the, you know, there's managers that have gone and gotten, like, MBAs and really understand this huge business
Do
plan.
They teach that at colleges, how to keep people off, what, heroin?
No one taught me that. Maybe that's the problem. Yeah. Maybe I should have gone to college for it. But I never, like, had, there was not, like, any, so my goal was always, like, I'm a facilitator for this artist vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get as close to their vision as I can, like help them accomplish their, whatever, their, it's world domination or
yeah, right,
whatever their thing is.
That sounds very honorary.
Very honorable goals. So when I say like, I was just with my blinders on, like, I just wanted to have a management company, manage bands that I thought were awesome and basically had a vision and we went for it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, that's when I started Manage This. And my first employee, David Newgarden,
who's still at it.
Who's the greatest. Yeah. And I needed like basically a right-hand person that could be like, you know, I work great as a group. Like mm-hmm. I'm a great leader. I'm a great admiral. I'm a great general.
you're talking about yourself now with the blinders on and all that?
Yeah, like, but I could be... Like, I like to be in charge, but I also like to have a team and mm-hmm. be part of a team. So it was good for me to have my own company.
Yeah. And you have the drive. That's the, you know, the passion and the drive.
Absolutely.
That's what you have.
So I started working with Guided by Voices. I can't remember how that all came together.
Matt Sweeney.
Yeah, Matt Sweeney introduced me to Guided by Voices. Matt Sweeney again.
Yeah.
Brought Guided by Voices into my life.
He brought Guided by Voices out of a ditch.
We've
made 10 records, but they're all under our bed.
They're all right here in this stack.
What do we do? And Matt Sweeney was like, this dude's a genius. And he ran around. I remember he ran around New York shouting about that band.
He was right.
Ever. And
you know, Bob Pollard's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant songwriter.
And he owes most of that actually happened to, I think, the beginning, the early stages.
Absolutely.
That was Matt Sweeney.
Matt Sweeney said, you got to manage this band. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
I'll do whatever Matt Sweeney says. I still would do whatever Matt Sweeney says. He's brilliant.
So, Guided by Voices.
Yeah. I was working with the Blues Explosion and Boss Hogg.
Really?
Yeah. So, but Boss Hogg.
How did that work with John? Because he was not much of a talker, right?
I was great with the non-talkers. Yeah. I talked enough for both of us.
Yeah. Did you get along?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
What a great band.
What a great band.
I just watched on the flight over. I watched this not so new movie.
Did you see Baby Driver?
Yeah.
Did you die with bell bottoms?
What a great opening.
Oh my God, what a wonderful opening. Read some of the interviews with the filmmaker.
Yeah.
The whole film was built around bell bottoms.
Wow. Yeah, that's
like he had that vision.
That's a spectacular film opening. I mean, that's good use of music throughout. I mean,
completely.
It's a pretty decent movie. I thought, you know, for an airplane movie.
Airplane
movie. I was like, this is entertaining.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that opening. I lost my mind. Yeah.
So Blues Explosion, Boss Hogg as well?
Boss Hogg, yeah. Boss Hogg, it was more Boss Hogg than Blues Explosion. Like it was one of those like bedtime talk. Christina was like, you know, you should get Janet to do some stuff for you. And then David brought Chiba Matto.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
Which was like the greatest. And Mark Eitzel.
Mm-hmm.
And
This was post-American Music
Club? Post-American Music Club. Yeah, I worked with Mark.
It's another one of those geniuses.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What a songwriter.
Yeah.
What a heartbreaker.
So you have good taste. Yeah. So you can't sell me on this Hootie and the Blowfish Matchbox 20.
I can appreciate that they sit and write songs.
Shut up. You suffered through this 1 year and then you paid your way out. That's okay.
I'm only working with stuff I like. I don't care if no one else likes it. And I, Lisa Loeb, who I still work with.
To this date, right?
Yeah, this day, 20 plus years,
okay.
23 years together. Yeah, I just is an incredible songwriter. And
Europe isn't for her, is it?
No, can you fix that?
Mm-mm.
She won a Brit Award. Is that like the curse?
Oh, she did?
Yeah, she won like Best New Artist.
When was that?
1990-something.
22 years ago.
Best New Artist, 20-something years ago. But yeah, like can't get England to, or anywhere, Europe to care.
And over here?
She does great here. She does great in Canada, the US, Japan, Mexico.
I actually don't know the first thing about it.
Yeah, she does great.
I don't know the first thing about her.
She's an incredible storyteller. She's a great singer-songwriter.
She's another Bob Dylan to you.
She's different than Courtney. She's like more Joni Mitchell. Like, she's a storyteller.
Okay.
You know, where Courtney's like a poet. Mm. Courtney's like a poet in a big way. Lisa is an incredible storyteller. It's just different. I think they're both different from each other.
So that was in New York.
Courtney and Lisa Loeb, they are very different from each other.
I was just going to let that stand there. So you're in New York, you manage this, and David. That's a lot of bands you just rattled off.
I know. And then Jackie Nalpiant came and worked with us. She was like my best friend from seventh grade. And we needed, right when we started.
She's a booking agent.
Now she's an agent. She's like a huge deal. Yeah. She's like a big macher, but she was my best friend from seventh grade and she was living in Columbia, Missouri and she was miserable. She's like, what am I doing in Columbia, Missouri?
What was she doing in Columbia, Missouri?
She's a waitress.
Okay.
At a bar.
And then you said, come work with me.
So I said, no, I said, I was setting up my company and I needed literally to get the phone lines installed, get lighting put up, get the computer set up. And I was traveling for a few months. Like, I was going on tour, doing whatever. So I said, what, can you come to New York for a month? Get the office set up.
Put some light bulbs in.
Put some light bulbs in. Because, like, who do you... I need a voicemail system. I need a conference
David
system.
David wasn't there?
No, David was starting, but David was doing, like, manual, like, the work of managing, right? But I need someone to, like, deal with, like, ordering the desks and the phone systems and, like, that kind of general office work. Mm. And I just needed someone I trusted. Like, it was just literally about, like...
To buy the right desk.
What's going to, like, not run on my credit card and not make stupid decisions. Someone that's going to do it, like, you know, smartly and not... And think about overhead. Like, someone that just says, like, just someone I trusted. Mm-hmm. And Jackie was one of the smartest people I knew. She's my best friend from seventh grade. We'd still been in touch through all the craziness that I'd gone through work-wise. She was always just, like, my bud. And, not needy on any level.
So you brought her into the music business.
Yeah. So I was like, Jack. And then after I came back, like I was gone for like 3 or 4 weeks and I came back and Newgarden was like, Jackie works here full time now. It's us or you're out.
All right.
And so Jackie's husband then moved up from
Missouri. She was married.
She was married at the time. Yeah. She married this guy in Missouri. And it was me, Jackie, and David.
And when did she get out of that and became a booking agent?
Then she wanted to move. She had a baby. She got pregnant and had a kid during this whole time with my awesome health insurance because I provided my employees with great health insurance.
Ooh.
And and so she wanted to move to the West Coast to be with her sisters who both lived in San Francisco. So she was like, I'm going to move there and I'm going to go work for Frank Riley, who we knew from booking bands. Mm-hmm. And Frank was like, great. I can't believe how lucky I am to have someone so awesome. Mm. So she worked with Frank Riley for a couple of years and she met the Monterey people and met Chip Hooper, who I think just basically changed her life. And
good for her.
I know. She's doing so good. It's so exciting to see her be such a rock star. It's the best. And she is like, can always hook up concert tickets.
So you, so how long did, before you moved over here?
It was all sort of vague. Yeah. Then I just moved to LA. I don't know. I think.
But you were still managing all of these bands or just some of them?
Yeah. Still managing everyone.
Okay. And you just decided to pack up and leave.
Oh, no. I was then managing Courtney again.
Wait. Oh, when did that happen?
I can't remember. It was.
Wait, no. Why would you do that?
I don't know. Question. I stopped managing everybody when I went to Atlantic. Mm. And then I rebuilt everything when I went to manage this, when I started to manage this.
But she was managed by Q Prime in between.
Right. So in between, she was managed by Q Prime. Mm-hmm. And then I think at a certain point, Q Prime and her broke up.
They sort of orchestrated the whole, like, okay, let's get this right. You know, because, Live Through This had kind of tanked. It wasn't until Q Prime got involved and convinced Geffen that this is worth giving a second breathe. And then they started making videos and then and this is early 95.
Yeah.
I remember this because I was somewhat involved in Europe. And then it just, boom, just went off.
Wow.
And then it became a huge record. Again, MTV was there to just hammer the videos.
It, yeah. Yeah, I left, I think, in the middle of Live Through This. Okay. And that's when Q Prime got involved.
So when did you come back?
I can't remember.
Okay, good.
But I started working with Courtney again. We had this film company, and we were going to make a movie.
Oh.
We started a film company together called Epitome Films. And I moved to L.A. to, like, work on that. Because
that's where the film business is.
Yeah, exactly. So we had New York going, and I moved to L.A., and I can't remember the details.
Well, didn't she then, but then she did that movie shortly after. Didn't she do The People versus Larry
Flint? Yeah. She did Larry Flint and Man on the Moon.
And were you involved with that?
Uh-huh.
Were you managing her at the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was super exciting.
And did you have it together at the time?
Yeah.
Or did you wear your blinders? No, I mean, I'm just...
Okay. I don't know. Like, was she on drugs?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Whether she kept it together and was... you know, good to work with.
Yeah. It went south shortly after that. Like the movie, she was great. She was super together and she had a great boyfriend. Ed Norton was this incredible actor and he really kept her on the straight and narrow. And then I was working with her. She had signed to Virgin. I don't remember what year this was and made a record called America's Sweetheart.
That's much later.
That's much later?
Yeah. There was, wasn't there like, well, there was a couple, was there one more whole record after Live Through This?
Yeah, Celebrity Skin.
Yeah. So.
I didn't work with her then.
Okay.
Well, anyway, I ended up being here in LA.
Yeah. But the Virgin record was in 2001 or two.
Oh, okay.
Were you still working with her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cause I, she was working with someone else. And Courtney and I, I guess, were in and out of each other's lives professionally.
How are you now?
We were fine, and then now she's really mad at me about something.
Mm. It'll pass.
Yeah, I'm not worried. I didn't do anything wrong. I just, like, got caught up in something that she's got pissed about. But
Do you know what she's doing?
I don't know what she's doing.
I mean, is she doing anything?
I heard there's a whole reunion coming, but then that fell apart. I have no idea.
Okay.
I really have no idea.
All right, so you're here, but then you open up a whole new chapter of activities, right?
I mean, yeah. Then I, so I went, I moved, then I got pregnant.
Mm-hmm. That's a new chapter.
That's a whole new chapter. Yeah. But I was still managing bands.
Right.
And basically I had twins and at a year old, they were like more mature and more independent than any of my clients.
Well, but there you go.
I was like, that's done.
A proper assessment.
And it was really after living with my husband and my husband being like, it's not normal that the phone rings all night long. At the phone at 2 a.m. and you get call waiting.
Yeah.
He was like, this isn't normal. And I was like, it's not. I had no idea. No one ever said to me, when you got on my phone calls on 7th Street at 2 a.m, when everyone else was answering my phone at 2 a.m, no one ever said, Janet, this isn't normal.
Right.
Like, I had no idea. I had no modeling of, like, what work life was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. This, to me, was work. And my husband was like, this isn't normal. The phone shouldn't be ringing all night. And now you have these two kids. You were gone, like, 100 nights, like, the first year of their life.
Right.
And he was like, this just is no bueno. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'll quit. So basically dropped all my clients. And
when did you get married?
I got married in 2000.
And, you know, you added a name to your name.
I did.
Janet Billig Rich.
Oh, my God, which is only funny to German people.
Don't shout.
Okay, sorry, because it's funny because I always say no one gets the joke unless you're German. Yeah. You get the joke.
Affordable rich.
Right.
Like, so, you know, billig is German for cheap.
Or cheap,
affordable,
yeah.
Right?
Well, the first time I went to Germany and I saw billig in the windows, like on sale. I was like, what? I thought that was so awesome. I always knew it as cheap.
It's a great name.
Yeah.
Billig Rich is a great name.
I know. So I married my husband, Rich. Married up.
Yeah, you married up. You married Rich.
I married Rich.
So, okay. So
Mr. Rich said to me, this is not normal. And I was like, well, so I basically just dropped all my clients and was like, I'll just do whatever comes my way. And that's why I got into this really bizarre book of business that I have now.
And that is?
I really do a lot of everything.
Okay, but you ended up back on Broadway.
I ended up producing a Broadway show called Rock of Ages.
I know, which strikes me as the most bizarre thing. So that became huge, right?
Bigger than anything I ever worked on.
Rock of Ages. No, you worked on Nirvana.
I know. And Rock of Ages is more universal.
Yeah.
And more universally loved.
Okay, so this is what strikes me as so odd in this whole thing is that you working with the grunge and the Nirvana, you changed, those guys and everything changed the course of rock music and kind of put the last nail in the coffin of poodle rock, hair metal, or whatever you want to call it.
They did.
And then you come back out of this and you produce the poodle rock, the ultimate poodle rock music.
I love that you're able to see that connection because I see that and it blows my mind. I'm like, no one knows how brilliant this is.
Yeah. It's and I hope it's made you a lot of money because it's not Hootie and the Blowfish because you just went back to these Don't Stop Believings and all of these classic
pre-existing songs. It's funny because I was never into that genre of music at all. My 80s was The Cure and U2 and The Police. And
Talking about, we had good taste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
well,
this
what
80s.
We thought was good taste. Yeah.
Well, what was so interesting about this 80s is I never owned any of these records, but I knew every lyric to every song.
Right.
Because it's like just everywhere in your world. It's like at the supermarket. And it's just like, I never listened to rock radio, but I knew every lyric to every Styx song or Aria Speedwagon because somehow they're just like in our culture.
I know.
So it was weird to me. Like, I didn't know which song was by Motley Crue and which song was Styx, but I knew the song. I knew all the words.
Wow.
So luckily, Chris D'Arenzo, who wrote Rock of Ages, was really like, the music is in his heart and soul. And he wrote it, and my job really was like to make all the rights deals and the music deals.
So you were the music business person.
I was the music business
person. He came
to
and said, oh, can you help me? This.
Yeah, well, no, I was in it. I was involved before Chris. I'd gotten involved with Matt Weaver, who came up with the idea. He's a producer who I ended up, after I dropped all my clients, and I had met Matt, and he produced movies, and he had this idea for a theater show. And he was like, I want to do a show where at the end everyone's singing Don't Stop Believing. And I was like, that's a great idea.
Sounds like a Democratic convention.
Exactly.
Nowadays.
Forever the optimist.
Right.
So Matt just had this vision, and his wife Hillary was a theater producer, and she had met this young director named Kristen Henge. And Kristen and Hillary were producing Pussycat Dolls on the Sunset Strip, like their first show. And so they had this whole Sunset Strip vision. And then Matt said, I want to do this show with everybody singing Don't Stop Believing at the end. And Kristen and Hillary was like, the world of the Sunset Strip is where this needs to take place.
Oh, okay.
And so it was just really like all those things. And then it was talking to writers. And Kristen got introduced to Chris D'Arenzo. And he came in and pitched us basically like 75% of what you see on the stage of Rock of Ages is what Chris pitched us in that room, the whole story of, you know, people coming to LA to follow their dreams. And sometimes their dreams don't work out, but they still rock.
Okay, that's that. So you were involved in that in a bigger capacity than just the music person, right?
Yeah, I was so excited. I produced it. I got a Tony nomination for producer.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So like a hands-on working producer.
Yeah, I learned so much about the theater business.
Right.
It's a whole like skull and bones.
So you put that on Broadway and it was an instant hit?
No, it was completely like every day, like the hustle. But people loved it. And the New York Times gave it a great review, like a love letter review.
Oh.
And that changes the course of any show.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like the movies where it's like the newspaper comes out the next day and it's like, it's a 10.
Okay.
And then everyone buys the tickets to the show. It's really like that in theater.
And now a major motion picture, right? I mean,
yes.
Then it became this Tom Cruise film.
I wasn't involved that much with the film.
No?
Unfortunately. Yeah, that was a drag. That was a real disappointment because it would have been awesome to be able to be involved with it. But it was licensed to make a movie by a big movie company.
So some studio bought it.
Yeah. And they made the movie they wanted to make, which was kind of heartbreaking for our team because it wasn't the movie we would have made.
Oh.
But I have a huge credit on it. It's very exciting.
Okay.
But it's not the movie we would have made.
Let's not go into that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah, so it's, this is basically, and this is ongoing. Is it still playing?
Yeah, it's still musical? Playing. You could see it tonight. Many places in, like, you know, I play stock in amateur theaters. Your local theater group can do it. It's on the Norwegian Cruise Lines. Like,
wow.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Okay, so that was and from that you went you did more like TV and film.
Yeah, I work a lot.
More theater work.
I do some theater. Yeah, I worked on a show, Come From Away, which is touring now, and still on Broadway. And I'm working on Clueless the musical. With Amy Heckerling, who calls my phone, and I die because I'm such a huge fan of hers. Mm-hmm. And, I'm involved a lot in theater. I work on a lot of documentary films on the music side of things. I worked on a Steve Aoki documentary called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead.
That's the EDM dude, right?
Yeah. He's interesting. The movie's interesting. His dad starred Benihana. It's really what's interesting. It's a father-son story. His dad started Benihana, you know, the restaurants.
Oh, okay.
His dad was this guy, Rocky Aoki, who was like this interesting dude.
All right.
The movie's good. Watch it on a plane. <All right. laughs> It's no Baby Driver, but...
It's a documentary.
I love music docs.
Right. Yeah, like, same here.
I love watching music docs. I love working on music docs.
Yeah, there's
some
good ones out there now. I mean, there's so many docs.
Everyone has a doc.
So many, yeah.
If you're of note, you have a doc.
Yeah. But there's some really good ones. But generally, I like docs. I like documentaries. And, and some just masterpieces. And I mean, like that OJ five-piece thing.
Oh, my God. That was incredible.
That was just some of the best TV, I've ever seen.
Things that are a real deep dive. Like, I can really...
When the guy who does it puts it together, and it's so much more than the story of OJ.
It's just
the story of segregation and blacks and whites and all of it. It's amazing.
Yeah, incredible. Like, really, when you get this big, broad look at things.
But music docs, God, yeah, there's a lot of them. But, some of them are real fun.
Worked on a doc about sushi, Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
No, you did? Yeah. I love that film.
And that Matt Weaver, who came up with the idea for Rock of Ages, produced Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And then Chef's Table, which is this incredible series on Netflix that Dave Gelb, who directed Jiro, directs Chef's Table.
Oh, are you involved with Chef's
Table? I'm not, because there's I'm a fan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm,
Do you like food?
I love food.
And you picked up alcohol at 27?
That's when I first started.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started drinking.
I
still don't drink that much. Right. I know it's a disappointment for the wine owner. But
you like wine?
I do like wine. I find it quite delicious. I don't have, like, a discriminating palate.
But do you know what you want?
Yes.
Or do you drink anything?
No, yeah. I know what I want, for sure.
What do you like? Come on, let's nerd out on wine for a second.
Oh, right. We can talk about wine. Okay, so I used to love red wine.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden, every time I had red wine, I could start sneezing all of a sudden.
Oh.
And so then I asked a lot of people, and like apparently I'm allergic to...
Histamine?
Yeah, maybe... No,
maybe you've got some intolerance.
What's something with an S?
Sulfites,
yeah.
But that's, they're in white wine as much as in red wine.
Really? So then I just switched to white wine.
No, but that's full of sulfites as well.
Is it?
You need to drink natural wine.
Natural?
Well, we'll go to a place
like organic.
Yeah.
And then I drink a lot of sake. I love sake.
Okay.
So I drink sake.
Well, I'll educate you a bit about the wine thing. Okay. Sneezing is no good. Do you have any allergies?
I have so many allergies. Oh, you know? Yeah. Horrible allergies, like eyes red. Yeah, but I love wine.
Okay.
And I love food and wine.
Well, I think then we should go out and eat something.
Definitely. I like martinis the best. I like a vodka martini.
Yeah?
Definitely.
Yeah. I'm not so big on that stuff, but that's okay. Let's go out and have a martini.
Okay, done. Or we can have wine. I'm fine having wine.
Great. Let's spill the wine. Thanks for coming in.
Okay.
Thank you. That was a great chat. And that is just what we did right after. We went out for a glass of fine natural wine in LA. Which wasn't easy, but we found some. So, that was Janet Billig-Rich with her blinders on, getting the work done. Still, I love her.
She's wonderful. I owe her more than I will ever be able to express or pay back. If I look back at the things that changed the course of my life, my work, just my existence, well, this fine lady single-handedly changed everything. So thank you, Janet. And to you, my dear wine spillers, I do hope you enjoyed this interview. I guess I should ask you now to give my podcast a good rating in the iTunes store. That's what other people do. But then who knows how much longer that store will even be there. It's all Apple Music now. But hey, if you listen to this podcast on Stitcher or on Spotify or wherever, I hope you will come back. There'll be more. So see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks again for tuning in. Bye.